From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A few years ago, the journalist Maggie Jackson joined us to talk about the distractions of a digital world, the millions of websites and blogs and search engines and text messages. Jackson said that all of this stuff is eroding our capacity for deep, perceptive attention. Well, the psychologist David Strayer says this isn't just a hunch. Late last year, Strayer released a study that revealed the actual benefits of turning off the gadgets and taking a hike. Here's one finding. After just 4 days in the wilderness without any kind of electronic device, people are 50% better at creative problem solving. Today in the program, we're talking about the costs of all this distraction, on how our brains develop, on the way our emotions develop. Really, it's a case for just going outside. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the costs of all these distractions in the digital age, the cell phones, the blogs, the instant messaging. And we're discussing how putting all of that aside and just going outdoors can actually make us think differently. The University of Utah psychologist David Strayer is among our guests today. He's a walker, a hiker who spends a good amount of his time in nature. So he's always figured there was a difference, but now he can quantify it. Strayer's research is showing there are measurable benefits of turning off the gadgets and going outside. One of the findings is that just 4 days of being in the wilderness without a device, people are some 50% better at creative problem solving. We're talking about how we explain how technology is actually rewiring our brains and helping us think emotionally. David Strayer is a professor of psychology at the University of Utah. He directs the university's Applied Cognition Lab. His work focuses on attention and performance, and he co-authored the study I mentioned. It's called Creative in the Wild. It appears in the Science Journal Plus One. And David Strayer, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, I guess let me go back to when you started thinking about all of this, maybe even before you started studying all of this. Has this been in the back of your mind, this question of attention and the effect of all of this? You know what I mean? What got you thinking about all of this?
Well, I think being in Utah and just being able to go down into southern Utah and escape the all the cell phones and technology, I noticed in my own thinking that I just started thinking more clearly. It was actually a very profound feeling of noticing things more clearly, hearing sounds that I didn't hear before, smelling the smells of the desert that I didn't notice when I first got there. I just became a little bit more attuned to being in the natural environment when I was down there. And every time I'd go down, I'd wonder what was it about being down there that was changing how I was thinking and feeling, and just started doing background research to try and figure out what others had learned. Mm-hmm. First thing I learned was that nature writers had known about this for hundreds of years, yeah. And so I wasn't the first by any means. And probably a lot of people are going to say, well, why do you need to do studies on this?
Or duh, right?
Yeah. And I think the question is, it's one thing to kind of have these anecdotal experiences, but it's another thing to actually put it to the scientific test to be able to understand exactly what is happening. And ultimately, we want to use the results of what we've done to try and understand what's happening in our brains. Why are our brains somehow behaving differently after we've been out in nature for some period of time and set aside all the gadgets that are on our modern everyday lives, the cell phones, the texting, the tweeting, the Instagram and Facebook. What we know in our modern urban environment is where that stuff is crowding out our interactions with nature. Yeah. And so people are not interacting with other people, and they're not interacting with nature. They're interacting with, virtual in this virtual world of the computer. And that just kind of led us to start to try and do experiments to try and see if we could figure out what really was happening and could we actually measure the benefits.
I want to get to the experiments here in a moment, but you said something that that I noticed, and I wanted you to sort of see if you can drill down on it. You say that we think differently when we're out in nature, and I wondered in what way. I mean, describe if you can, or explain the quality of thought. What's the difference, do you think? We're not as fragmented, I guess. What is it?
I think what people talk about is kind of being in the present. As opposed to ruminating about all the stuff at work and all the office politics or worrying about some future event. You're kind of in the moment. And a lot of people talk about this as taking a little bit of time to develop. So you can go on a nice hike and get some benefits for sure. But if you go down to southern Utah and spend 2 or 3 or 4 days on a rafting trip or hiking, you find really, and I would characterize it as a qualitatively different mental experience. You just, the visual experience of what you see is richer. You notice sounds and you can smell and you can connect with the physical environment in ways that you weren't doing before. It was as if it was kind of everything was muted.
Yeah.
And by getting rid of this constant multitasking, by getting rid of the modern urban environment and reconnecting with nature, I think it helps to recalibrate our senses in a way that's kind of probably more associated with, you know, how humans evolved hundreds of thousands of years ago, interacting with people and interacting with natural environment, with trees, streams, and fresh air.
So, well, now the other part of that, which I wondered about too, is if there isn't some part of the, you know, the limbic part of our brain that kicks in evolutionary-wise when you're out in nature, which is looking for predators. Do you know what I mean? And there's that thing that kicks in where you are more in tune. It just so happens that you are really paying attention.
Yeah. One of my co-authors, Ruth Ann Ashley from Kansas, talks about how our modern environment is constantly barraging you with things that capture your attention, horns, sirens, your email binging when you get a new email and so forth. And every one of those, to be honest, engineers have been very good at figuring out what captures your attention. And so, you know, the modern environment's constantly grabbing your attention and pulling it one way or the other. Those are creating orienting events, minor little, basically working on the threat system. And so we've created a kind of a modest, but nonetheless a kind of a threatening environment, which you've triggered this kind of fight or flight mechanism all the time with all this technology. It does capture your attention, but in a way that, you know, in the past, 100,000 years ago or 1,000 years ago, if you heard some kind of, you know, sudden onset, a twig snapping or something like that, that was something you needed to pay attention to. You better orient to it because it's going to be either – it's going to be life-threatening or potentially it's a, you know, some prey you're after. Now our entire world is filled with this, and so we've completely reversed the equations in terms of what, you know, the kind of experience humans evolved in and the experience we have these days.
All right. Well, let's talk about how it is you test this sort of thing. Essentially, go through this for us, because you essentially there were some 56 people that you sent off into the wilderness for a couple of days. And I guess it matters the age group you send out. I mean, were you looking for younger people who, you know, that group that's kind of thoroughly ensconced in technology for which it's more – so it's kind of more intuitive, or did that matter, I guess?
Well, I suspect actually that you see that the younger generation tend to be a little bit more connected with all the newest technology.
Yeah.
We just mainly wanted to try and find a group of people who were willing to go out into nature for 3 or 4 or 5 days. We'd done it. I teach a class here on campus where my students go out for that period of time. And we tried a few informal tests. Actually, my background is in cognitive neuroscience. And so one of the ways we test is with computer-based programs and just measure how quickly people can react. First thing we found when we did those studies was that students didn't want to have anything to do with the computers. They were out in nature and they wanted to be out in nature. And, yeah. And they didn't want to sit in front of a computer pushing keys. That plus imagining all the moths and ants and everything that were crawling on the computer screen created it didn't work.
Right.
And so we started to look for simpler tests, and one of my collaborators specializes in creativity, and the idea is that the prefrontal cortex is one of the areas that becomes overused in our modern urban environment because you're constantly having to switch attention from this to that to this to that.
Yeah.
And so if you – that'd be one of the areas that's associated with higher level cognitive thought, problem-solving, creative problem-solving. And so we just used a very simple paper and pencil test. And in the study, we had half the people measured before they actually went on a hike, and then the other group was in for 4 days. And we found a 50% improvement in their scores, or a 50% difference in their scores. We've also done it where we have the same person measured on different days and found the same effect. So it's not like there's some kind of a one group was smarter than the other. There seem to be real effects that are associated with disconnecting from our modern environment and interacting in nature.
You send out 30 men, 26 women. Do women experience the wilderness differently than men in any way? Did you find any gender differences in the study?
We didn't see any gender differences, and I don't know if there are any with respect to this. There could be or there may not be. We weren't looking at that first, but just looking to see if people in general really benefit from interacting in nature.
So you used this remote associates test, right, where apparently it sort of gives participants – you give them 10 sets of three words.
Right. So the remote associates test looks for trying to find relationships between, say, a set of three words. Yeah. There is not an immediate obvious what the answer would be. And the test has been around for 40 or 50 years, and there's kind of a set of norms. So it turns out to be a beautiful test for measuring creativity. And then you just say, how many items can you successfully solve either when you're just sitting at your desk in kind of the modern urban environment, or do you get any better when you're doing that test after you've been out disconnected for 3 or 4 days? The elegance of it is it just is a paper and pencil test. So in terms of expense, it's really minimal. In terms of the logistics of doing the study, it's a lot easier than dragging a laptop out. And we know that doesn't work.
Right. So here's the question. Is it the nature part that's making us more creative? Or is it just the fact that we're laying off the technology? I mean, if you were to give them just take them to a basement somewhere and not give them access to their smartphone and their laptop and all that kind of thing. Would we get the same kind of results? Do you know that?
I don't think we know for sure, but yeah. I would, if I had to hazard a guess,
yeah.
I would say that that you would not find the same benefits. That the research and the theories that have been proposed in some of the earlier studies have found that there's something special about interacting in nature. For example, there was a study that was done in Michigan that had people hike for about an hour in an arboretum, or another group hike for about an hour kind of in a city urban setting. And then they measured differences to see if there was anything in terms of their ability to pay attention or yeah. to kind of ignore irrelevant information. The benefits were associated with hiking in the nature and not just from hiking in a kind of an urban setting. So I suspect it's a little bit of both. Yeah. It's probably over-connecting in our modern world, and when you set that aside, you're going to get benefits. It's probably also that you're actually acting in nature. You're actually part of nature. There's probably a kind of emotional association. You mentioned the limbic system, but we know the amygdala is probably going to be involved in kind of emotion regulation, mm-hmm. and so that's going to be helpful. It's probably going to be helpful in terms of reducing stress, and you give some physical exercise as well. So the nice thing about it is, the prescription is really quite simple. If you go out and you can hike for even if just a couple of hours.
You don't need to go out for 4 days.
The biggest effects are going to be when you're out for longer periods
sure.
of time. But you're right. I mean, most people can't in their regular daily life go out for a four-day period of time. But you get benefits from hiking in the park or taking an hour stroll in some kind of nature preserve. Those benefits, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that you can reduce blood pressure, remove stress. It helps for a more graceful aging process. So you find older adults who are walking regularly actually tend to have a more healthy and satisfying lifestyle.
Hmm. You've described it this way. You say when we get away from the hustle and the bustle, our brain can replenish. But what does that mean exactly? What do we mean by replenish?
I think that's the big question. I don't think we know for sure. Yeah. One of the ideas is that you've, like a muscle, you've overused the portions of the brain that are responsible for switching attention from one task to the other task to another. And those are the prefrontal cortex that tends to be really associated with that. If you do brain imaging studies, a lot of times you'll find that area of the brain, the frontal portion of the brain, heavily involved in kind of modern multitasking activities. And if you stop doing that for a while, you're going to get that area to replenish. I think what we see when we see these really longer-term effects is it's probably something beyond that. Okay, it's going to be certainly replenishing and letting the frontal portions of the brain kind of restore. But there's something that we quite honestly don't completely understand about what it is that's happening inside the brain that's actually making you think more clearly. It's partly that, but it's partly the resting of the frontal portions of the brain, but it's probably something that we still are kind of, you know, trying to figure out.
Before we head to a break, let's take a call. Krista is with us in Salt Lake. Krista, welcome.
Thanks, Doug. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I had David Schrader's class on the cognition in the wild, and it was a life-changing experience for me. I'm a much more committed environmental activist now. I was one of those people who would write letters and do all this other stuff, but I never was a more on-the-ground kind of person like I am now.
So what, Krista, what's the difference? What changes when you're off in the wilderness? What is the difference in the way you're paying attention to the way you are, you know, at home when you're distracted by other things? How do you describe it?
I feel more connected. I felt more connected to the people who were in the class, for one, and I felt more connected to the place. I felt more part of probably than I ever have on this planet, which made me so much more committed to saving it. That's why I was crying at the auction where Tim DeChristopher did, because I felt it so viscerally.
Do you have these experiences where people bond in your class? Like
yeah,
that?
I think actually that's one of the really interesting things that took me by surprise was that the students create interpersonal interactions where they become friends and carry on these kinds of exchanges where they have that more so than probably any other period of time. So they'll say, for example, I've been taking classes at the university for 3 or 4 years, and I never really had a chance to really meet anybody. And this time when I'm out in nature and I've set aside all the technology, I'm talking to people really face-to-face for, in some cases, the first time, and I really have made some really fantastic acquaintances. And that, for some reason, just isn't what the modern student life is these days. They're connected oftentimes to Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and everything else and not actually interacting with people.
Well, it's the perfect segue, I have to say, to our next guest, which we'll get to when we get back from a break. Clifford Nass, a professor of communication at Stanford University, studies these emotional interactions, the impact of technology on the way we develop our sense of emotion. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the costs of all these distractions of the digital age, the cell phones, the blogs, the instant messaging. Professor David Strayer is with us, professor of psychology at the University of Utah. He's co-author of a study called Creativity in the Wild. We've been talking a bit about that. He's joining us here. Joining us now is Clifford Nass. He's a sociologist and a professor at Stanford University. He directs a lab there, the communication between humans and interactive media. His books include The Man Who Lied to His Laptop, and recently he's been focusing on the impact of technology and multitasking on cognitive development. And he's joining us from the studio of the campus of Stanford.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
I wanted to talk about an essay that you wrote not so long ago where you talked about you tell the story about seeing an old girlfriend at a high school reunion sometime ago. Can we start there if that's okay with you? Because
sure.
I thought the conversation was really interesting because she said something to you that you sort of triggered on. And she said, technology makes emotions easy. Start there, if you would. What did you make of that?
Well, it was actually a student in the dorm who said that I was recounting the fact that I had received old love letters when I was at a high school reunion, an excruciatingly painful experience.
Yeah.
And the student in the dorm was texting someone.
Oh, I see.
And I said, oh, I just saw him down the hall. Would, you know, you can just go and see him. And she said, no, there's no reason. I recounted that the love letters we wrote at a time when phone calls were expensive. We obviously didn't have the internet or Skype or such. So there was no way to see or hear the person. We're filled with how difficult it was to not be able to see the other person and hear the other person. And I said, you know, it's remarkable to me that you're willing to text someone down the hall. And she said, well, you know, you make emotions sound complex. They're really quite simple and easy. And I don't think that's the case. I think there's an enormous amount lost when younger people don't practice the intenseness of face-to-face interaction.
Yeah. What do you think she meant by that? That it's more – was she just talking about the basic sort of convenience of it all in some way?
Well, I think actually there are a few things going on real briefly. On the one hand, we see that on social media sites, people tend to only express happy things. Facebook may have supplanted Disneyland as the happiest place on earth. And so you have a world in which everyone expresses happiness. And happiness and positive emotions are much, much simpler than negative emotions. I think also the need for speed. When you're looking at someone face to face, their face can change in tenths of a second that we're sensitive to. But if you receive a comment via text, you have time to ponder and think about what you'll do next. And so the lack of speed, the lack of richness, and the bias towards positivity all do seem to conspire to make emotions much easier for younger people.
Can we divide young people into, because you write about this in this essay, can you divide young people into the real life kids and the online kids?
Well, I think there's actually four groups. There are the kids who are essentially isolated, have no social interaction. There are the kids who are high in face-to-face and low in online, high on online and low in face-to-face and high in both. What the research seems to suggest is the kids who were having a significant amount of face-to-face communication seem to do very well emotionally, regardless of how frequently they are online. Hmm. And it's the kids who are not having that face-to-face interaction that really seem to be showing much worse social and emotional development.
Talk about the effect online social interactions are having on young people. Because you talk about – it's interesting, particularly for young women who talk about how they feel more rejected, how they feel less normal.
Exactly. We looked at 8 to 12-year-old girls. We did a survey of 3,400 of them along with Professor Roy P. and a number of graduate students and undergrads. And basically, the kids who are heavy online and low face-to-face interactors show feelings of lack of, you know, feeling less normal, feeling less integrated, as you say, rejected, having more friends who are bad influences, even getting less sleep. They don't seem to be well integrated, and we can know for sure, but we suspect that the cause and effect is at least both ways, if not that the constant use of online, the constant removal from face to face seems to have very, very negative effects.
How much time are people? Let's make a comparison if we can. How much are young people not interacting face to face, you know, using screens to sort of for their social interactions?
Well, there's a great spread, but we do see a large percentage of young people having most of their interactions not face to face. And even when they could be face-to-face, we see a phenomenon that we normally only saw among two-year-olds called parallel play, two kids sitting next to each other, but each with their tablet or phone or whatever. So they're physically proximate, but not psychologically proximate. They're not engaged with each other. They're engaged with the screen.
It seems like there's a critical window whereby young people develop this emotional life. It's different for young women than it is for different men. You write about that in your essay. But talk about that, though. What do they need during that window in order for them to develop the kind of healthy sort of emotional life? They need actual interaction. They need to, I guess, be seeing those cues and developing that kind of muscle memory, I suppose.
Exactly. At the most fundamental level, they need to pay attention. So the human face, the human voice, and to a lesser extent, the human body, are all built to intensely and richly manifest an enormous range of emotions. We smile or frown, the crinkle in our eyebrows, the eyes, the retina, the everything. Our voice carries so much richness. But only if you notice it. If you're not paying attention, the phrase I use for this is emotional atrophy. They just, if you don't practice this, if you don't have the intenseness of interaction, if you don't have the ability to learn from other people, humans aren't built to know what to do with their emotions. We're built to have emotions. We're built to observe emotions, but we're not built to know what to do with them. And the way we did learn that was by observing others, by watching how they reacted to their emotions, observing how they managed and regulated their emotions, how they made sense of their emotions. But all that assumes we're really paying attention. Just one of my favorite examples is when I was young, the expression you heard all the time from adults directed towards children is, "Look at me when I talk with you."
Yeah.
And you never hear that. It's startling how infrequently you ever hear that. And that's because the value of looking at someone's face has been downgraded.
I want to ask you about the effect all of this seems to be having. There's a study that you've written about by the Children's Digital Media Center at UCLA, which really sort of gets at young people's values and how, I guess, it shows how they're starting to shift, it seems.
Right. So it was a fascinating study that suggested that now the number one value that young kids aspire towards is celebrity, fame. And that seems to have to do with the notion of a rather superficial valuation that if everyone knows you and has some vague sense of you, that's the best thing you could have, as opposed to fewer, richer, more intense, more stimulating, more maturing relationships.
So benevolence, community feelings grounded in emotion. That's moving down the list of values, I guess.
It seems to be, empathy is a very, very complex emotion. And if kids aren't getting practice in even the more basic emotions, really being able to work through empathy is going to be very, very difficult.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. David Strayer, let me bring you back into this conversation. There's a question directed to you from Thad, who writes, "Your research examines people's use of technology. You generally find people overestimate their ability to navigate the technological world. They can drive and use the phone, they think. They can hike and multitask." So he asks, why is there a general disconnect between that research, what research tells us about technology and what people are willing to believe about how technology affects them?
Well, I think it's a good question. Generally, people tend to overestimate their abilities in a variety of domains, and one of them is their ability to be able to multitask. better than the average person. I think one of the in terms of these higher level cognitive abilities that start to become eroded with excessive multitasking is the kind of self-awareness of how good you're doing. So, for example, a large number of people who use a cell phone while driving think that they're better than average drivers. And so what happens is, even though they're almost in a near accident, they'll kind of chalk that up to something other than their own failings. So again, it's just this kind of you're so engaged in all this multitasking on a in terms of all the other kind of media, social media, texting, talking on a cell phone, that you just are actually not processing some of the cues in the physical environment that would actually say you're not doing well. It's similar to the stuff that Dr. Nass was just talking about in terms of not noticing some of the facial expressions that you might have noticed if you hadn't been connected all the time. You just are not processing the information in a way that would you would if you were just kind of disconnected for a while.
Right. Professor Nass, what do you think about that question?
I think Professor Strayer is exactly right. The importance of connection, you know, as we've discussed, is extremely interesting research. One of the things we've talked about is that nature both demands and encourages attention. And in a world in which attention is devalued, when you go out in nature, you not only feel compelled to do it, you also feel a great enjoyment in doing so. So I think one of the things that happens is you learn to value attention again.
Back to the phones. Michael is with us calling from Bountiful. Michael, welcome.
Thank you.
Sure.
I just finished a month-long artist in residency at Zion National Park. And in terms of creativity, when you're out in the natural world, it is so much more beautiful and unimaginable and unpredictable. And it is like the source of all kinds of different thinking and observing when you get out there, and even a juniper berry glows and everything, and the shadows and the light and the changing. I just don't see how you could create within a technologically enclosed kind of environment. And I will leave that comment with you.
Good. Glad you did. Thanks very much. Well, I guess the question is, David Strayer and Clifford Nass, so I wonder if there's a kind of lagging effect. Younger people who have grown up where, you know, with all of this technology, what effect is it going to have on – are we going to see it in the quality of literature, for example, or the quality of art, for example? Are we going to get more, you know, feeble plays or bad poetry or not as many kinds of innovations? Have you thought about it that far? Clifford Nass, you first?
Yeah, we have started to look at, for example, the writing of high and low multitaskers, and very preliminarily there's evidence that we see a lot less sort of narrative continuity. So the world is more a Twitter-type world or a jump-from-link-to-link world, the sort of tight narrative where themes appear again and again is vanishing. And of course, consumers may be the same way. If they're not really paying attention, they won't notice the repetition of a narrative. So we do begin to see those types of things.
Hmm. What do you think?
Well, I think actually we don't know for sure. We've engineered an environment over the last 30 years that's just radically different than what was there 30, 50, 100 years ago. The personal computer is only 30 years old. And I think the concern is, especially some of the work that Dr. Nass has done, suggests that that technology has a double-edged sword, and that it can allow a lot of interesting abilities and kind of help out in terms of in a variety of ways. But there may be a darker side to it, and if we do it all the time at the expense of interacting with other people and interacting in nature, we may be losing something that's kind of essential to being human.
But I wonder also if somehow human creatures are evolving to deal with that if there isn't some general inclination to find meaning, to find wonder in something, and if it doesn't happen to be a sunset in a wilderness, that they'll find it somewhere else, you know, in a something technological or a picture of something. Does that make sense? Are we evolving? Could there be a good thing that we get out of it because we're trying to make the most of it? We're adapting as a species.
We will adapt as a species, but a virtual reality is not going to be probably as rich as a real reality, and interacting with real people is going to be more meaningful than interacting with robots or some other kind of artificial kind of interactions with people. So I think that in terms of the real evolutionary kinds of things, that takes place on a much slower scale. In terms of the fact that our mental experience is shaped by the environment we grow up in, the environment that kids are growing up in now is very, very different than it was 30 or 50 years ago. And if you are not learning some of the important pro-social behaviors, and if there is a critical period, so if you don't learn them in time, that, I think, is what we're concerned about.
Hmm. Professor Ness, what do you think about that?
I think Professor Strayer's right. You know, humans evolve very slowly. Our brains are remarkably plastic.
Yeah.
We can change to a lot of things, but these fundamental impulses and the institutions we have structured, you know, the way we structure schools and the way we structure the workplace are built around certain assumptions. If those change radically, if the importance of attention is devalued, eventually you could rethink schooling to appeal to those other things, but it's going to take a long time. So if the technological world and our responses to the technological world change rapidly and institutions don't evolve with them, and of course our brains and bodies evolve even much slower, it's going to be a tough time.
Back to the phones. Caitlin is with us in Ogden, Utah. Caitlin, welcome.
Hi. I just have a question. I have a young daughter, and I increasingly worry about her physical safety. I feel more inclined to write her with a cell phone, but then I also worry about her emotional development, so I'm just wondering where the balance is.
Wow, that is a great – David Strayer, start with that question. The people are they give their kids technology because they want them to be safe. They want them to be – they want to be connected with them. And then, so how do you find the balance?
Well, having a cell phone for emergency purposes is tucked in a backpack probably isn't an unreasonable thing to do. It's not overly expensive to do, but if – the kid at the same time, your child at the same time starts to engage in texting all the time. And we see kids now who are sleeping with their cell phone under their pillow. So in the middle of the night, when a text comes in, they can text right back. That's the slippery slope to behaviors that are not productive. The other thing is that, there's a lot of the sense of feeling unsafe is, you know, to some extent, not borne out in the actual statistics. You know, in terms of violent crime, in terms of the kinds of things that you see, they're really highly publicized in the media, but in fact, they're becoming less frequent.
And I guess Clifford Ness, the point is, no one is saying technology is a bad thing. It's just it's the way it's used, the way we use it, I guess, is the point.
Sure. I mean, you know, Professor Strayer and I couldn't do our research. It's hard to imagine doing research without access to the internet, without access to all these. I mean, I can't even know. I don't know how anyone did it before.
Yeah.
So clearly technology and, of course, you know, cell phones can be incredibly valuable in enabling coordination and other things. It really is an issue of, is it a complement or is it the primary means of communication? And that's really the test people can do with their kids. If their kids are really inclined to have rich interactions when they can, and then when those interactions aren't possible, using the cell phone or other media as a complement or supplement, those kids are going to do fine. It's when the technology replaces or becomes seen as an acceptable or sort of, you know, perfectly fine substitute that we tend to see the concern.
Clifford Nass is with us, a professor of communication at Stanford University, the author of The Man Who Lied to His Laptop, What Machines Teach Us About Human Relationships. And David Strayer is here with us, a professor of psychology at the University of Utah, co-author of a study called Creativity in the Wild. We'll take another brief break back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the costs of all these distractions in the digital era on the way our brains develop, the way our emotions develop. Let's go back to the phones. Richard is with us in Ogden, Utah. Richard, welcome.
Hey, afternoon, Doug. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
As usual, thanks for having such a thought-provoking conversation. I'd like to add that I'm a pretty exceptional multitasker. I just got done with some flight training up at Ogden Airport. And I've been driving home, listening to the radio, and waiting to get through. So I'd like to engage the panel on what my experience has been. I'm in instrument training right now, which is, you know, flying in the clouds with no perceptual thinking. You have to just rely on instruments. And it does take a lot of what I thought was multitasking, but some of your previous shows have really challenged my thinking on that. And it's just, am I just quickly going through and thinking about each variable in the plane, or can I really brag about being one of those exceptional evolved humans that have a ability to multitask? What is it about certain folks that have the ability to be pilots or other professions that require multitasking?
Well, David Strayer, you've thought a lot about this, but let's start with Clifford Nass first. Do you have something to say about in response to Richard?
Yeah, there's two types of multitasking. The one that we're concerned with, the one that's worrying, is the one where you're doing unrelated tasks. The brain is built to integrate, and Professor Strayer knows much more about this than I do. The brain is built to integrate a large number of streams of related information, and there's no evidence that that's harmful to the brain. So if you were doing, while you were flying your instrument panels, also reading a book or something like that, that would be multitasking and likely be extremely dangerous.
So, David Strayer, it's possible Richard's a, what do you used to call him,
supertaskers, yes.
Supertasker. There aren't many, but they do exist.
Yeah, so about 2.5% of the population seems to have extraordinary abilities to multitask. And if when we've tried to figure out what makes someone's brain different, it looks as if the frontal portions of the brain tend to be operate in extremely high levels of efficiency. And those kind of rare situations are the worry we have is that a lot of people think I must be one of these super taskers, and they're not really aware of what their own limitations are. But there are a small group of folks that do this where they're trying to actually, as Dr. Nass said, juggle a number of separate tasks at the same time that aren't integrated.
Here's an email from Ed who writes, Gary Snyder says of the natural world that it is not only what we think about, but what we think with. The same, he writes, is true of other aspects of our education. As fully realized people, the books we read, the music we listen to, everything that goes into the making of the person, when the breadth and depth of this kind of input is limited, our ability to think is impoverished. David Strayer, I guess that's the point, right?
Yeah, I think that what happens is you create a much richer environment when you're actually interacting in the real world, and especially in kind of a natural setting. If you go down to the stunning Red Rock areas in southern Utah, for example, you can't help but just totally have this whole body experience. And if you just look at a photo of it, maybe one of your coworkers comes back and shows you this photo. it's nowhere near as rich for the person who's looking at the photo as it was the person who's actually hiking around in nature.
Yeah. Let me read this from Jess, who writes, "I cannot blame our obsession on technology on every tragedy, but I do strongly believe it's our fundamental disconnect with nature that has allowed our culture to desensitize horrifying acts of violence. Children," Jess writes, "spend hours watching violence, shooting in video games, furthering themselves from empathy and morality. If those children were left to their means outside, they could have the opportunity to connect with something real and good." So it's hard to find Clifford Nass and David Strayer causal connections between video games and violence and those kinds of things. But surely you must think about what the connections might be between that kind of thing. Clifford Nass, do you spend much time thinking about that?
It's not my particular expertise, but we do know that people don't draw as strong a line between mediated reality and physical reality as one might think. That's not to say there are no differences, and certainly Professor Strayer's work absolutely makes clear those differences. But at the same time, we do learn a lot about what is normal from media. And if media presents images that are either inconsistent with reality or inconsistent with what we'd like reality to be, people do draw conclusions from that.
Karen is with us in Park City. Karen, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
So my question or my predicament is that I'm a speech-language pathologist, and I specialize in working with babies, kids under three. And the program I work for recently purchased iPads for the entire staff to use in therapy with the little ones that we're working with. And for me, what happens when I turn on the machine is the child loses attention with a human being and becomes engaged with the machine. And that defeats the purpose of why I'm there working with the child. So my inclination has been not to use it. And I feel good about that. But then when I hear so much media press about how great these iPads are with children, I think maybe I'm not pursuing it as diligently as I should. And I'm curious what your panel has to say about that.
Clifford Nass, what do you think?
Well, technology is seductive, right? The things you can do in ways that the physical world, especially the urban world, isn't. I think Professor Strayer's work suggests that the outdoors, the wilderness, is incredibly seductive. So the answer is that no, especially in areas like speech pathology, where attention and focus are just so critical. And from what I know of the area, watching the face move as it makes sounds, as it speaks, is hugely important. So, no, those technologies are fundamentally distracting. If in instances where you want real focus, that's exactly what the students of Professor Strayer's who were out in the woods did. They learned that in the natural world, you can really focus and see tremendous benefits from it. So no, creating distractions in that environment seems mistaken.
Yeah, I think you need to worry about all the flash and the sexiness of some of this technology. Mm-hmm. And you need to basically, if you can make it, be motivational and figure out what your goals are and make sure that it doesn't subvert the goals, then that technology can be very useful. I don't think any of us are Luddites in saying that technology is bad, but if you use it all the time and you're not careful about how you use it, you can become a slave to technology, and that's not a good thing.
Karen, thanks very much. Back to the phones. Jay is with us, also in Ogden. Jay, welcome.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Fine, thanks.
That's good. Very interesting topic. I have a couple of nephews so hooked on the computer and the internet. And I tried to explain to them how to get out, do things, and let their imagination wander out instead of on the computer, like we did growing up. And I'm just wondering, how do you get them to get mindset off the computer era and let their mind wander and create new things to do in the outdoors?
David Strayer, what do you think? I mean, this—it's not really something you study. This is, but as a parent, maybe you can give him some guidance.
Well, I mean, I would look at the class I teach as a good example. Those kids are as connected as any college student would be with 24/7 access to social media and so forth. I take them out and I disconnect them from that. And to be honest, their first experience is a little bit that this is going to be scary and threatening. After 3 or 4 days out without the technology, they're really reluctant to come back. So to some extent, they have, in many situations, college students haven't been exposed as much as they could be to, you know, just how interesting it is to be out interacting with other people in natural environments. They're instead seducted by the flash of some of this technology, and they just need to break that cycle.
Let me ask you this finally, and both of you. What happens when a young person whose emotional life is developed in this era of digital technology and multitasking? Can they, Clifford, and ask you first, can they go walk into the wilderness and have their brains replenished, or have they already been rewired? Is it going to be more difficult?
Well, I think it may be slightly more difficult, but I think Professor Strayer's research is so compelling precisely because it shows they can have their brains change. You know, brains are remarkably plastic, and there's not just one part of the brain. So which parts of the brain we use can be heavily influenced by the environments we're in. So, no, I'm actually quite optimistic that people can do it.
You must be too.
No, I think you definitely can. Remember that's really our evolutionary history. We're kind of wired to interact with in nature and with face-to-face communication. It's just to some extent we need to practice it. And if you don't practice it, you'll get the atrophy that Dr. Nass was describing.
That's David Strayer. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Utah, co-author of a study called Creativity in the Wild. Professor, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Clifford Nass, a professor of communication at Stanford University, author of the book The Man Who Lied to His Laptop, What Machines Teach Us About Human Relationships. Thanks very much to you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Susan Anderson and Taylor Almond. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.